Buddhist Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You are listening to the sound of universal compassion.
Hello and
please
welcome.
Enjoy.
Thanks for joining the program today. Recently, I read an article on the website pursuitofhappiness.org on caring. It bore out quite well what we've been talking about over the last couple of weeks, that when we care for others or hold them dear, not only do they benefit, but we do too. Of course, the Buddhists would say the major benefit from caring for others will come in the future life, but the researchers mentioned in this article found immediate benefits for the carers as well. Anyway, here's the article in full, and you can make of it what you want. While the heading is simply caring, the subhead reads, people who care for others' well-being through acts of altruism, volunteering, or formation of communal relationships seem to be happier and less depressed. This seems to be especially true in older individuals. The article continues, most people who care for others in a selfless manner do so because of a genuine desire to help and improve the world around them. Nonetheless, modern psychological research has shown that caring has benefits for all involved. People who volunteer or care for others on a consistent basis tend to have better psychological well-being, including fewer depressive symptoms and higher life satisfaction. Caring behavior even has physiological benefits, as current research shows that individuals who receive social support, a form of caring behavior, are more protected from disease and even death. And he quotes Broadhead et al., 1983. The article continues, although caring can involve volunteering as part of an organized group or club, it can be as simple as reaching out to a workmate or classmate who looks lonely or is struggling with an issue. Studies show that people who reach out like this can benefit in multiple ways. Some individuals care for others through acts of altruism and organized volunteering, while others prefer monetary donations and engagement in communal relationships. The majority of studies agree that there is a significant association between caring for others' well-being and increased positive affect. Several studies have found that this correlation appears to be highest in older adults who participate in volunteer activities. And he quotes Morrow Howell et al., 2003, Wheeler et al., 1998. The same level of correlation has not been found in younger adults as a whole. Yet, a subgroup of younger adults who engage in sustained volunteering over long periods of time do in fact have high levels of psychological well-being. And he quotes Wheeler et al., 1998. The authors of this study speculate that many young adults who volunteer for short periods of time may have been encouraged to volunteer by their schools or did so to boost their chances of getting into college. In contrast, older volunteers tend to cite moral responsibility. This suggests that intrinsically motivated volunteers, that is, those who are motivated for the sake of volunteering itself, feel more satisfaction than extrinsically motivated volunteers. And he quotes Midlarsky Kanar, 1993. One more intriguing set of data reveals that the recipients of volunteer activities who were encouraged to participate or cooperate in some way tended to experience greater happiness. In contrast to this, those who passively received the benefits did not become significantly happier, and in some cases became more depressed. As is true for other areas of research, it is considerably more difficult to prove that volunteering causes improved mental well-being than to simply identify an association between the two. At least one study, however, has attempted to do the former with a prospective randomized trial, and this is Yuen et al., 2008. The authors of this study randomly assigned a population of older adults into one of two groups, a group that volunteered for 3 months and a control group that did not. At the end of the trial, the researchers found that those who volunteered scored higher on indices of mental well-being than those who did not. These effects persisted 3 months after the end of the trial, indicating that the benefits of the volunteering may be long-lasting. The article goes on, while volunteering is a heavily cited example of caring behavior, current psychological research strives to understand the factors that drive certain individuals to be more caring than others. Do individuals with a highly altruistic family tend to care more for the well-being of others? Or could feelings of elevation induced by witnessing another person do a good deed motivate helping behavior? More broadly, how do cultural practices and beliefs influence caring behavior? The answers to these questions suggest that caring behavior is largely context-dependent, where social influences heavily influence how individuals care for each other's well-being. For example, a 2001 study sought to understand how cultural contexts influence the caring behavior of British and Taiwanese college students. Results show that caring behavior manifests differently in cultures that value independence over interdependence and vice versa, where a balance of the two values leads to greatest levels of well-being. So we can see from this article that people who care for others consistently are psychologically better off and get more out of life than those that don't. They are also better off fending off depression. Also, caring doesn't mean being a persistent do-gooder. It covers a whole range of activities focused on others, from volunteering to just being generally ready to help wherever help is needed. This is consistent with the Bodhisattva intention to train to give the best assistance possible in every situation. I find it interesting that older people benefit the most from caring for others, perhaps because they have less of an agenda and are more ready just to help for the sake of it. And this indicates that motivation is important, as Buddhism stresses. If younger caregiving volunteers are motivated by outside agencies like schools or churches, or volunteer for the good of their CV, or to build a reputation, the psychological benefit to themselves is significantly less than for others whose motivation is more purely altruistic. As the article says, and again Buddhism would agree, it appears that those who are intrinsically motivated benefit much more than others who are extrinsically motivated. On the other side of the coin, the active recipients of care have a much better experience than passive recipients, who may even become more depressed by the care that they're receiving. I guess this makes sense also. If you feel unable to participate in your own care and at the mercy of someone else, you may well feel disempowered and miserable. Perhaps the most important of all the findings was that people who voluntarily cared for others experienced a heightened and lasting sense of mental well-being. This would indicate that the more we care for others with an altruistic motivation, the greater our sense of mental good health. And that well-being will last way beyond the time we would expect it to. If we devote our life to caring for others, particularly where there is little material reward to ourselves, can we expect to feel highly fulfilled and generally happy? It would appear so from this article, and Buddhist texts like Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun indicate that it is so. This is not to say that we give up our independence entirely and become subservient slaves of others. The final observation of the article points out that our greatest satisfaction comes from acting out of a balance between values of interdependence and independence. But now, before going any further, perhaps we should take time out to think about our motivation for participating in the program today. Wouldn't it be great if we can use the program to learn something that will help in our caring for others, especially in the long term? Then surely the program will have fulfilled its purpose. So in our quest to help others in the best way possible, let's set a motivation to attain enlightenment for that very purpose. Thank you. Going back to the theme of independence and interdependence, remember the story of the four harmonious friends. It's a famous Buddhist story, at least among the Tibetans, who often make paintings of the four, one on top of the other. I've taken the following version from the website nexusnovel.wordpress.com, where it appears like this. This story perfectly demonstrates harmony, interdependence, cooperation and friendship between four animals who became close friends. I first heard it on a PBS show on Bhutan, and it really impressed me. In Bhutan, the story gives a national identity for people to live in harmony with nature, for people to cooperate with each other, even with cultural differences, and for families to work together. A conservation ethic has arisen based on it that influences Bhutan's national policies. The story is a familiar Tibetan motif derived from the Jataka tales of Buddha's former lives. In terms of a symbol understanding of this beautiful allegory, the elephant represents our body, the monkey represents the restless mind, the rabbit represents emotions, and the bird is the soul. Here's the story adapted from Buddha's channel. Once in a forest in Varanasi, four animals, an elephant, a rabbit, a monkey, and a partridge, disputed about the ownership of a tree where all of them had fed. The elephant claimed, "Well, this is my tree because I saw it first." To this, the monkey replied, "Now, elephant, do you see any fruits on this tree?" The elephant agreed that the tree was without any fruit. The monkey continued, "That's because I'd been feeding on the fruits of this tree long before you ever saw it." Next, the rabbit spoke up. "I fed on the leaves of this tree when it was just a sapling, before the monkey ate its fruit, and way before the elephant ever saw it." Finally, the partridge, who'd been watching the argument, came forward and asserted, "The tree belongs to me, because the tree wouldn't have grown if I hadn't spit it out as a seed. I helped plant the seed that grew into this huge tree before the rabbit fed on it, or the monkey ate its fruit, or the elephant saw it." The elephant, the monkey, and the rabbit conceded that the partridge was the first to know the tree. So all of them bowed to the partridge and regarded it as their elder brother. The four animals became friends and decided to share the tree together in peaceful harmony, enjoying the beauty of the tree's fragrance, the nourishment of its fruits, and the bounty of its shade. They worked together to obtain fruits. The fruits on the ground and on the lowest branches, the partridge and the rabbit found by working together. The monkey climbed the tree and dropped the fruits for everyone to share, but only the elephant could reach the highest branches with its trunk. The four animals worked cooperatively, and with their combined strength, each one benefited and no one went hungry. Other animals in the forest often saw them together, with a partridge on top of the rabbit, who was held up by the monkey who rode on top of the elephant. Since then, they were called the Four Harmonious Brothers. The four animals were looked upon as an example of peace, harmony, cooperation, interdependence, and friendship. Caring for each other, we nourish the conditions that lead to harmonious lives. But we don't have to give up our own identity for care for another. Here is another story, a true one of our times, that demonstrates this. It's taken from the website of Maria Shriver, the ex-wife of Arnold Schwarzenegger, though the story is not written by her. It is written by Tinky Weisblatt, the author of the book Pulling Taffy, A Year with Dementia and Other Adventures. Tinky, as she will describe, lives in a small town in the USA called Hawley, and her story tells what it's like to be a resident there. She writes, "I live in a very tiny place, in population at any rate. My late neighbor, Florette, used to marvel that our hometown of Hawley, Massachusetts, has about the same square acreage as Singapore. Singapore houses about 5 million people. Hawley houses about 300. Ironically, one can often feel more isolated in a packed city like Singapore than in a spread-out hamlet like Hawley. Urban areas are physically dense, but not always emotionally dense. Many city dwellers enjoy their anonymity, knowing that they may do pretty much as they please without being observed by their neighbors. High-rise urban apartment buildings can hold more people than reside in the whole of my little town. That density of population can make monitoring one's neighbor's business difficult. Occasionally, I long for the anonymity of a large city. Here in Hawley, my neighbors are aware of just about everything I do. They know when I drive down my hill, where and when I go swimming, what I watch on television and read, who visits me, what I write for the local paper, and what my political views are. From time to time, this interest makes me feel confined, as though Big Brother were somehow looming over me and attempting to control me. Most of the time, however, my hometown's busybodiness actually helps me take note of and enjoy my freedom. My neighbors' interest in me and in each other isn't malicious. In general, small town dwellers are interested in others because they care about their fellow residents. I find this interest liberating. I feel free to drive very carefully down my steep hill in winter. If my car gets stuck in the snow somewhere below my house, I can walk home secure in the knowledge that the members of the road crew know whose car it is. These helpful, strong men will cheerfully dig the car out, come up to my house, transport me to the car, and help me maneuver it up the road. In summer, I happily walk to the local pond for a swim in a bathing suit that cannot hide my chubbiness. I know that everyone around is familiar with my general shape and can look beyond it to the parts of me that matter. I watch whatever I want on television and take any book I like out of the library. My neighbors can and do see the TV screen through the windows. The librarian knows exactly what I'm reading and doesn't hesitate to comment on it in a carrying voice. If the neighbors and the librarian don't approve of my choices, we talk. Talking about my choices makes me more thoughtful about them, but it doesn't keep me from making them. I feel free to invite anyone I like to eat or stay with me, knowing that I may have to introduce my guests to neighbors who will stop by out of curiosity, but also knowing that anyone who visits will receive a courteous welcome and the chance to make new friends. I say and write whatever I like, despite the fact that others are listening and reading. In fact, the knowledge that people are listening and reading gives meaning to my words. I am always, consciously or not, in dialogue with those around me. I feel free to express my political views. Not everyone in town agrees with them. Nevertheless, being surrounded by a lively variety of viewpoints forces me to think through my political positions and to express them as diplomatically, intelligently, and coherently as I can. My neighbors aren't Big Brother with a capital B, trying to make me adhere to a party line. They are brothers and sisters with small B's and S's, my peers. We start any political dialogue with the reassuring knowledge that we all hope to strengthen our community. And in general, we end up agreeing about the things that matter. When my late mother was ailing, I felt free to keep her company by myself. I knew that if we needed help, and we often did, neighbors would come to our rescue. The emotional, although not physical, density of Hawley, Massachusetts doesn't limit my life. It does help shape my life. It encourages me to explore and to grow. I can live alone happily in my hometown, knowing that I will never be lonely, that I will always be free to express myself in a caring community. Independence and interdependence can coexist and enhance each other. So, it appears that if we can get this coexistence of independence and interdependence right, we can live happily while contributing to a healthy and vibrant community. Of course, not everyone wants to live in a community in which everyone knows everything you do, but that might be a small price to pay to escape a situation in which everyone has only one person in mind, oneself. Nam Kapel, the author of the text we've been following, claims that this is the cause leading to all our suffering. It ignores the fact that we are dependent on others for everything we enjoy, everything that makes our life easy. If we had to trace back the history of this shirt on our back, we would see that countless beings have contributed to bringing this shirt to us. It did not magically appear on the shop shelf, although to our unthinking mind it may appear so. Many beings were involved in getting the raw materials, processing them, bringing them all together, shaping and forming them into consumer products, transporting them, arranging them, and selling them. And this is true for everything we use and enjoy. Nothing is excluded. So even in this life, we are benefited by so many beings. Do we ever think about them and have some gratitude? Mostly not. Of course, we do come across beings whose intentions do not include our well-being. In fact, some may be downright antagonistic and belligerent. How are we supposed to see that they benefit us? Well, first of all, Nam Campbell makes a point that might be a little difficult for Westerners to swallow if they have a problem with rebirth. He writes, "Those who are harming us have in fact been our mothers countless times before. We've eaten their flesh, drunk their blood, gnawed at their bones, and worn their skins times beyond number. If all the milk and curd we have drunk were gathered together, a vessel the size of the three worlds would not contain it. The times we have killed, beaten, and robbed them also cannot be counted. We have taken their kindness for granted on all those occasions, and now should repay our debt to them thinking, remembering your kindness, this is our duty." He pays particular regard to those who cause us harm, saying, "Singling out those we apprehend as enemies, we should enhance love and compassion by means of both giving happiness and taking suffering. We should particularly rely on those who harm us, since they provide the basis for us to practice patience. Even the six perfections arise from relying on them. Because these foes are an object of forbearance, we can meditate on patience. If we have patience, the two perfections of generosity and ethics will have preceded it, and the other three, effort, meditative stability, and discriminating intelligence, will be derived from relying on it. When we let our thoughts turn over the significance of this, we will realize that objectively it is our foes who place enlightenment in the palms of our hands." When talking about giving and taking, he's talking about the practice of Tonglen, in which one envisages in meditation taking on the suffering of others and giving one's own happiness to them. "We should especially do this with our enemies," he says, "because it is they who give us the great opportunity to practice patience. They are, in fact, not our greatest foes, but our dearest friends." Well, how much do your actual friends test your patience? Maybe a little, but not much. Mostly, our friends are good to us. They try not to be a pain in the backside when they are with us. But being nice to us does nothing to develop our patience. In fact, we might start feeling entitled and get upset on the odd occasions that our friends don't do what we want. But our enemies, given a chance, they would not only not do what we want, but would strive to do the opposite to what we want. This really puts us into a situation of practice. We will want to retaliate and harm them or humiliate them, wouldn't we? This is kind of natural. If you harm me, be sure I will do whatever I can to get you. But that only leads to an escalation of harm, because the enemy will then get back at you for your harm, and again, you will want to retaliate with even more harm, and so it will go on. His Holiness the Dalai Lama comments here, "On our side, our minds are filled with a habit of self-cherishing. On the side of other beings, they have untamed minds, which from the force of their unawareness or ignorance are filled with disturbing emotions. Their disturbing emotions lead them into all kinds of situations that we find disturbing, and then our self-cherishing attitude and selfishness cause us to want to harm them. We can see this with the example of the Chinese. We can see self-cherishing at work on both sides causing harm. This has been the result of the past build-up of negative karmic force on both sides, and we are now building up further negative karmic force from our impulsive destructive actions. These actions will only cause further situations to arise in the future from which more harm will happen to us as the result. To get rid of all these things that harm us, the text instructs us to develop the two bodhicittas and the six far-reaching attitudes." That's the six perfections. "To develop bodhicitta, we must have genuine concern for others and great tolerance. To develop tolerance, it is necessary to have enemies. If there were no obnoxious people, no enemies, there would be no way for us to develop patience and tolerance. When we look at what will bring us to enlightenment, namely true stoppings and true pathways of mind, neither of them has an attitude of wishing to either benefit or harm us. True stoppings refer to the third noble truth, the truth of cessation. That is, end of all sufferings brought about by the elimination of negative afflictive emotions and karma. True pathways of mind refers to the fourth noble truth, the path to cessation, or if you like, the path we have to follow to reach nirvana. His Holiness goes on, true stoppings are static phenomena, so they don't have any attitude. True pathways of mind are simply states of mind, and they have no particular motivation or wish to help to bring us to enlightenment. Now look at various enemies, friends, and so forth. These are what actually bring us happiness or unhappiness, but not simply in terms of actual physical pain. We have doctors who give us injections and perform operations and the like, and although they cause us pain, we wouldn't call them our enemies. This is because they have an attitude of wishing to benefit, not harm us. So enemies are called enemies not on the basis of whether they have knives or guns in their hands, but rather based on their attitude of wishing to harm us. So, if we wish to develop patience and tolerance, it is necessary to be faced with someone who has this harmful intention. On the basis of our tolerance, we can develop ourselves and achieve enlightenment. But then he goes on to tell the story that shows developing patience with the enemy doesn't mean becoming their doormat. The story tells of an incarnation of the Buddha before he became enlightened. At that time, he was the captain of a ship carrying 500 merchants and all their wares. One of the men on the boat decided to kill everyone else on board so he could take all the merchants' products. The captain was clairvoyant and could see the evil intent in this man. He knew he couldn't persuade him not to do it, but also saw that if he didn't do anything himself, the murderer would not only bring great suffering to his victims, but through the negative karma would suffer unbearable consequences himself. So, out of compassion for both the merchants and the intended killer, he killed the man instead. He was prepared to go to hell himself because he had just as much compassion for the intending killer as the killer's victims. And with that, we must say goodbye, for now our time together is up. Thank you very much for joining the program today, and please dedicate any positive potential to gaining enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. I do hope you'll be with us again next week. Goodbye.
language on planet